Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Newman, a host on this channel. Today we're speaking with Rocio Gomez about her book, Silver Veins, Dusty Lungs, Mining, Water, and Public Health in Zacatecas, 1835 to 1946. The book was published in 2020 by the University of Nebraska Press as part of the Mexican Experience series. The author, Dr. Gomez, is assistant professor of Latin American history at Virginia Commonwealth University. Rocio, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
So as you put it in the first lines of Silver Veins, Dusty Lungs, this is a book about the earth, how different groups used it, and how it made them sick. Before we learn about this story, could you share with us how you came to it?
Yeah, so there are personal and professional reasons of why I chose this topic. And it kind of begins back in childhood. I moved around a lot as a kid, and one of the places that I lived was in northern Nebraska, just across the state line from Pine Ridge Reservation. And in one of the places that my family and I used to go to on weekends to just relax and enjoy ourselves was a lake. And next to this lake was a playground. And I remember those memories so vividly. But one particular occasion, we visited that lake and we saw that this lake had been drained. And we saw dead fish on this muddy lake bed. And then we saw turtles struggling through the mud. And this was a recreation area that was important to the indigenous community and also to my family, just for a place to, just to have a place to unwind on weekends. So looking back on why that happened, I now realize that that was when the Ogallala Aquifer had just been tapped and had been, and that water had led to the draining of that lake. But yet this was a community space, and I often asked myself, why was that lake targeted? Why was it okay to take that space away from our community? So that was one of my earliest memories with regards to how power dynamics can change landscapes, how power dynamics can change access to water. On top of that, I went to grad school in Arizona, and one of the topics of discussion in Arizona is so frequently water, namely because of the Central Arizona Project, or CAP. And for those that don't know, the Central Arizona Project is a 300-plus mile canal that basically brings water to southern Arizona. At the same time that I was in grad school, there were discussions about the Rosemont Copper Mine and having that mine in such close proximity to Tucson. There were discussions of how that mine would affect water resources, community health, but also how it would affect the Saguaro National Park. So these topics were very much at the forefront of my thought processes as I came to the dissertation stage. And then as another personal reason is that my family has close ties to the state of Zacatecas and the city of Zacatecas in particular. And I had seen on so many summer visits with my family, that mining was still taking place in that state, that it was still very much a fixture on the Zacatecas landscape. So kind of bridging, I think, my personal life with my professional life is that when I got to grad school, I wanted to learn more about Zacatecas mining, but I noticed that there was a gap in the historiography. Most of the literature on Zacatecas tends to emphasize colonial silver mining, and there's very little written about it in the context of modern Mexico. So I wanted to contribute to that historiography and help build that part of the historiography. In addition, this was also around the same time that I came under the influence or was very much influenced by the work of Nancy Langston's work on hormone disruptors, but also Mirna Santiago's work on oil in the Huasteca region. So both of those books were highly influential on my own research. So, yeah.
Thank you. So I think we'll hear more going forward about the specifics of Zacatecas as a place. But I wonder if first, if you could explain to listeners what you mean by an ecology of extraction and how this idea helps you tie together a book that's about mining and water and public health.
Yeah, so the ecology of extraction is a term that I used in the book that combines political ecology and social ecology. Political ecology came out of the 1970s, more specifically Eric Wolf's work with regards to resources and ownership. Political ecology looks at the power dynamics involved with regards to access, and really ask the question of who has access to these environmental resources and who owns them and who is controlling them. And it also asks questions with regards to really who are the people that are marginalized and are kept out from this access as well. In terms of social ecology, I'm looking more at the relationship of how humans interact with their environment, and more specifically, the ideas that they have of how the environment should be used. So together, I use the term ecology of extraction to combine both of these terms, the political ecology being, if you can imagine, almost an axis, political ecology being the vertical axis, and then social ecology being the horizontal axis, in order to understand how ideas of the environment and how ideas regarding mining really were affected by the power dynamics from the top down, but also on the social level, who were the people that clashed with these ideas and how they absorbed and fought back and resisted and adapted to these ideas regarding access to water and access to silver as well.
So let's begin with the early history of mining in Zacatecas and some of the sources that you found that help us understand conflicts over resources in the early 19th century.
Well, with regards to the sources in the early 19th century, it was really I just found lists and lists of denuncios. And denuncios were basically claims that were laid out by people who wanted to purchase mines, mining in Zacatecas, if you can imagine a silver mine as not just being like a hole in the side of a mountain, but rather being an entrance on the side of the mountain and then branching off into many different directions and many different branches. So it was possible for people to own a mine right next to someone else's mine in the same mountain. So these denuncios allowed people to, laid out an individual's claim to a particular mine, saying that they had the intent to buy this mine. These denuncios were frequently published in newspapers. And then anyone that owned that mine could say, actually, I'm the owner, and they could speak up and block that sale. Sometimes you had individuals who watched a particular mine, and if they saw no activity in that mine after a certain period of time, they would go ahead and say to the local mining council, no one is working this mine, it's been abandoned, I want to purchase that mine. And then the denuncio would go in the newspaper. Unfortunately, these denuncios were also used to swindle people out of their claims for particular mines. Early on, in after the Wars of Independence in Mexico, foreigners could not own land in Mexico, but still, they were able to maneuver themselves into the boards of particular mines or governing boards of particular mines. This allowed for an interest to slowly creep into Mexico. At the same time, you have individuals who were using mines only as a quick investment and for a quick turnaround. Inevitably, you have a clashing with agricultural interests in the state of Zacatecas. Zacatecas has always been a state that is caught between agriculture and mining. And this is very clear in the 1830s and 40s and 50s. In this time period, you have mines butt heads with farmers, in particular with water access. And so this is the question of how power dynamics really come into governing of resources, but also resource management and mining management as well. Another way that mining is inevitably going to clash with agriculture in this context is that many farmers, many individuals, many residents of Zacatecas rely on mines for their water. In the process of mining, as miners are digging down into the water table, they will run into water. And Zacatecas sits on many aquifers, and so you will see. It's often the case that miners will then have to pump the water out of the mine. And into streams, or they'll, if they're lucky, they'll have residents lining up with their buckets in order to get the water themselves. But when the process of draining water from these mines, you see farmers who will later say, well, I didn't have access to this water. I was never told I had access to this water, or that so-and-so is blocking my access to this water. So this is the first hint of what's to come later in the 20th century.
So as we learn through your book, the mining that is happening in Zacatecas in this era and going forward has impacts on the environment and the water supply in particular. So in your second chapter, you're talking not just about these impacts, but also how Zacatecanos, or people from Zacatecas, how they thought about water and how they understood it. So can you tell us a little more about the cultural meaning of water and how you were able to reconstruct that history?
Sure. It's during this time period that you have this is really, I think, where the history of medicine comes into it. It's during this time period that you have miasma theory very much in mode and very much ingrained in people's consciousness when it comes to water. Flowing water, clear water, was equated with good health, that it was safe to drink, that it was good for you. And versus standing water or muddied water, foamy water, was seen as unhealthy and something dangerous. And this is not going to extend to just large bodies of water. It's also going to extend to puddles and small ponds as well. So when it comes to the cultural meaning of water, mine water, that is the water that came from mines, was seen as clear. It was easy access, and so it was something to be valued, as something to be used in the gardens, and something to be cooked with, and so on. Versus water that was flowing from outside the mine, where slurry had just been dumped, or where dirty, grainy water had just been dumped as well. This was seen as dangerous water. On top of that, Zacatecas is an arid region. So people's relationship with water and ideas regarding water is already fairly fraught in that sense. And so when it rained, rains were seen as something valuable, something that would be crucial for the next crop. But at the same time, there's a threat that water is going to cause mudslides, it's going to cause flooding. And so you have this very tense duality between the good water and the bad water in the city. And it all really depends on where people are in the city. When there is a cause for concern, is where when you start seeing homeowners in the well-to-do parts of the city start being affected by mudslides, by torrential rains running through, causing flooding through their front yards and front patios. That is when people start getting concerned. But one of the great frustrations I had with this book is that if you look on the cover, there's an aqueduct right on the cover. And yet this aqueduct is very much a symbol of Zacatecas. It's part of the Zacatecas skyline. It's so characteristic of Zacatecas. Now, in addition to La Bufa, the hill that you see, that's so famous that you see in one of the pictures in the book. But yet this aqueduct is not very well documented in the archives, even though it is this cultural symbol of the city. But in a way, I think that it serves as a symbol of how complicated the city's relationship with water really is.
Thank you. The mine in your book, you explain to us that it's a place, a site where different kinds of violence can happen, whether criminal, accidental, and also the violence of disease. So could you tell us maybe one or two stories about these different types of violence and what connects different kinds of harm and death in the mines?
Yeah, and so... In terms of violence, I looked at not only criminal violence, but I also looked at accidents and the violence against the body in the mine. Mining itself is a type of violence, you can say, not only in the actions that are done to excavate and excavate a mine and excavate a mountain, but you can also look at the violence that's done on the human body. So miners and engineers were subject to this violence through accidents and through through occupational disease, which I get into further later on in the book. But in these particular accidents, you had engineers and miners frequently suffer from falls, in addition to accidents involving explosions, and also accidents when it comes to machinery as well. So I wanted to emphasize that these are not natural results of mining, but really tend to be products of the introduction of technology to a workforce that perhaps was not trained, perhaps was not alerted to the dangers of these technologies as well. In terms of, and in one of the cases, I talk about a young miner who had lit a fuse for a stick of dynamite and was waiting around the corner for the explosion to go off. And then when the explosion did not go off, did not happen, he ran around the corner only for the explosion to then go off. And he will die from his injuries because the mine was so far from the city center and from the nearest hospital. On another occasion, I talk about how an engineer, with a particular Mexican mine, Mexican-owned mine, was walking across a beam, and it was a German engineer who actually told him, "No, don't walk across that beam," and the Mexican engineer will sadly fall several meters to his death. So there are several occasions where you have several of these accidents happening because of perhaps impatience or simply ignoring warnings. With regards to criminal violence, I thought that those cases were interesting, namely because of where the violence took place. The violence happened in the mine. On one occasion, you had two individuals who had quarreled over the loan of a tool. And when someone refused to return the tool, and the other person asked for it back repeatedly, and then the other person attacked him and left him and threw him down an open shaft. So the resulting violence there is just illustrated the way individuals interacted in the mine, but also how the mine is seen as kind of a liminal space where it's just far enough from supervision, from the city, and in particular, an empty mine at night was an area that was really open for shady things to happen. Yeah.
Would you talk now about the politics of water during the late 19th and early 20th centuries? And I'm wondering what makes Zacatecas a special case for understanding how experts and leaders in this era responded to natural disasters and epidemics.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your question. With regards to water, water legislation is really going to take off in 1888, and it's going to happen actually under Porfirio Diaz. And Porfirio Diaz is going to lay out the law that says that all navigable rivers are under federal jurisdiction. And this law will be expanded on the eve of revolution on 1910. And then, of course, by that point, you really have a question of how water is being used in individual farming communities in Zacatecas, but also how is the mining industry using that particular water source. So in the late 19th century, you have the doors opened for an investment in mining. through to principal laws. The one that and you have the 1884 law, but then the one that the mining code of 1892 is the one that says that a foreign interest can own land, but they can also own subsoil minerals and, in addition, any waters that they discover in the process of extraction and excavation. This limits the access that individuals can have to water sources in mines. And for the farmers that depended on those water sources from mines for irrigation, for domestic use, for their animals, are really shut out in the process. In terms of what makes Zacatecas a notable case of epidemics, and when we say epidemics, we could talk about typhus, but also we could talk about the various ailments such as diphtheria and that swept through the region as well. Zacatecas is especially notable because you have so many seasonal workers in mining and agriculture. So individuals that were exposed to typhus on farms where they worked would later go and take typhus to mines, or they would take them to the city center. In the process, they would contaminate and other populations, and they would spread the disease further. So Zacatecas is especially notable because of how isolated the region is, but it also has a streak of independence in many ways. I mentioned early in the book of how it attempted to secede from Mexico in 1835, but also this is the region that really attempted to curb Benito Juarez's power when he ascended to the presidency. So there is Zacatecas has always has a streak of independence, as I said, but at the same time, it is very much underfunded in this time period, even though it remains, especially for the Diaz presidency, one of the richest areas in Mexico when it comes to silver mining. There isn't a medical school there, and there isn't a well-funded hospital there. So really, when it comes to the case of Zacatecas and epidemics, we really see how limited its resources were, but at the same time, how that was by design in many cases.
Your last chapter focuses on debates involving experts and also workers about which diseases were caused by working conditions in the mines and which diseases were not. So could you tell us a bit about the two conditions that were important to these debates, namely tuberculosis and silicosis? And also, you know, thinking about the context of the Mexican Revolution going on, how these debates illuminate worker struggles for rights in this era?
Thanks for your question, Rachel. In terms of the revolution and workers' rights and as well and occupational diseases, I think it's important to keep in mind the legislation that was initially outlined to protect workers. So you have Article 123, Section 14, which states that workers that are injured on the job were allowed to seek compensation for their injuries. In addition, in 1931, you have the Ley Federal del Trabajo. And the Ley Federal del Trabajo reiterates this right, that workers have the right to seek compensation. On top of that, the Ley Federal del Trabajo has a list of occupations and their associated diseases. So, for example, if you looked up miners, you would see that their occupational disease would be, one of their occupational diseases would be silicosis. And then if you looked up Mozos del Anfiteatro, or the workers that worked in medical amphitheaters, one of their associated diseases would be bovine tuberculosis. And so you have these diseases. Both of these diseases target the lungs. And so let me explain a little bit about the pathology of both of these diseases. So silicosis is a disease that typically occurs because of high levels of dust in the atmosphere and high levels of dust in the mine, especially when there isn't much air circulation. So you have silicosis broken down into three stages of the disease. So in simple silicosis or classic silicosis, the workers inhale the dust and then are left with symptoms of silicosis. And this could have, these symptoms can appear over the course of in years, especially if the worker is exposed to low levels of dust for several years at a time. And then you have accelerated silicosis, which can happen in 1 or 2 years at moderate levels of dust. And then acute silicosis, which can happen just in a matter of weeks when the workers are exposed to extremely high levels of dust for long periods of time. So in all of these diseases, you have, in all of these levels of silicosis, you have a progression of the disease. And so what does silicosis do? When the worker inhales dust, the dust is absorbed into the lungs, where many of the particles will stay. And the body's natural response is to build a fibroid around these individual pieces of particles of dust. And so over time, you have fibroids that build up inside the lungs that limit the expansion of in the inhalation process when the worker takes a breath, and also do not do a good job when in absorbing the oxygen, because that's what our lungs do. They absorb the oxygen and bring oxygen into our bloodstream. So with inhalation inhibited and absorption of oxygen inhibited, you have a telltale cough that the workers develop. So they begin with this cough, and then it becomes increasingly frequent. In acute silicosis, the workers then have other symptoms, such as weight loss, difficulty breathing, difficulty in holding their breath, and very low energy levels. It is at this acute stage that you can have the added infection of tuberculosis in workers' lungs. Their immune system is low. The cilia, the little tendril, little finger-like a tissue that we have in our lungs, those are disabled. And so it makes them much more susceptible to TB. Silicosis TB is it's a disease in itself, and it's very much tied to the occupation where the person worked. You have silicosis associated with metal mining or mining that has high levels of dust, just like you have a black lung that's associated with coal mining, and asbestosis, which is associated with the mining of asbestos. So it really depends on the materials that the miners are working in and working to extract. In terms of how this involves the revolution, is that that workers are going to be subject to, are going to seek compensation, but at the same time, they're going to be subject to federal arbitration. The federal government, because of the overwhelming silicosis claims against mining companies, the federal government will be seen as the mediator between mining companies and workers and their unions. In order for workers to seek compensation, or in order for them to receive compensation, they have to go through a very bureaucratic process, namely because they have to present a case through science, through medical science, in order to back up their claims for compensation. So in a typical examination, they would go in and to see their doctor. The doctor would ask them several questions regarding their occupational history. They would then have to cough up some sputum in order to submit a sample. They would then be subject to a chest x-ray, and in some cases, additional exercises in order to see if they are able to catch their breath in order to perform in day-to-day life. After going through this very time-consuming process, then their lawyers would, or then their representatives would take their case and ask them to be assessed by medical doctors. Medical doctors would look at all of the data, and they would say, this person has only 30% lung capacity, or this person only has 40% lung capacity. And then they would determine the compensation level from there. Unfortunately, medical science is incredibly subjective, even at this point. And this goes through, and this goes to how doctors who are perhaps not in tune with the health risks faced by mining communities are not going to really know the levels of dust that people are exposed to in the mine, or they're not going to know the effects of mines in the effects of the mine environment on the human body. But at the same time, we have to keep in mind that because both of these diseases are diseases of the lung, they can easily be confused for each other. And this is where mining companies really try to inject doubt into people's compensation cases. You have mining companies try to obfuscate medical data and say, well, you know, this person's not living in a hygienic community. And they try to turn it around and really blame the mining communities for their own diseases. And another way that miners compensation claims are really subjected to medical doctors' whims is that many of these disability claims or compensation claims are really quantified disability claims. So let me explain. When you have a doctor who's looking at someone's chest x-ray, they might say, well, this person only has 20% lung capacity, but that number might be different from someone else's, from another doctor's assessment. Consequently, you have really different ways that these claims can be limited and stopped by medical doctors. And finally, I think one of the, in 1940, there's going to be a push to have tuberculosis included in the ley de trabajo for miners. But this is quickly stopped by Avila Camacho, President Avila Camacho, in 1941, namely because, as he says, he cites data. But we know that mining companies were purposely obfuscating the symptoms between the two diseases in order to create doubt. So, yeah.
Well, this has been a fascinating and quite sad, actually, journey through your really important book. Before we wrap up, though, I wondered if you could draw out some connections between your historical work and the present.
Sure. We're living through a global pandemic that attacks the lungs. And so these masks that we've been wearing are recalling some of the images of the mining masks that were sold in the 1920s and 30s. With regards to, besides COVID, obviously, and masks, I really think that we are currently living through a mass disabling event where people with long COVID are seeing symptoms that are going to be questioned by legal authorities in the future as they seek perhaps compensation claims for their employers having made them work in person and or for having had them exposed to COVID in the office or at their place of work. So I think that there's one parallel there with my research. But another topic would be mining, of course. Mining is a increasingly, it already had a major presence in Latin America, but increasingly we're seeing more and more foreign companies take an interest in Latin America and its offshore offshore drilling sites. We see mining companies from Canada in particular really intrude into indigenous spaces in not only Central America and in Mexico, but also starting to look elsewhere in the global south. So I wish I could say that I paint a rosier picture, but unfortunately, I think we're seeing a second resurgence of mining in the 21st century.
Well, thank you for that crucial perspective. Rocio, it's been a pleasure to speak with you and really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rachel, and thanks again for having me.